It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. A clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It's Tuesday, May 7th, 2024. I'm Guy Benson. This is the Guy Benson Show from Washington, D.C. Very glad that you are here. 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time is when we air every weekday. We appreciate you listening. And if you miss a moment of the broadcast, there's a podcast of the whole show every day on demand as soon as we're done. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcasts.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm political editor at townhall.com, which is where my writing appears, a Fox News contributor. I've been very busy lately on TV. Here on the radio, I'll just give you a heads up. We are going to be heading out of town tomorrow, Thursday, Friday, doing the show from a place we've never done it from before. So I'm excited to talk more about that later on in the week. In the meantime, here today, great lineup. Our first guest joins us in just a moment. Douglas Murray will be here later on in the hour. Looking forward to that conversation with him. Byron York in our middle hour. KT McFarland also joining us to talk about foreign policy. Plus, just the catastrophe of a book tour from Governor Kristi Noem, South Dakota. I'm not sure I've ever seen one go worse. We'll have some thoughts on that. It's all ahead on the show today, but we begin with Andy McCarthy, Fox News contributor, longtime federal prosecutor, also a best-selling author. Andy, we so appreciate you making time for us. I know that demands on your time are myriad, so welcome back and thank you.
Guy, thanks so much. It beats having a real job, so I can't complain too much.
All right, you used to be in the courtroom prosecuting cases. Now you're watching this all play out and analyzing what's happening in Lower Manhattan. This is former President Trump, this now weeks-long trial about the hush money payments involving a porn star and the way that they were categorized on the books. And Alvin Bragg has decided to do something that his predecessor in the office declined to do, that the feds declined to do, which is to say, yep, this was a crime, and not only a crime, not just the misdemeanor, which has lapsed, it's a felony. In fact, it's dozens of felonies, and we can put him in prison for a very long time. And the theory of the case we'll come back to, because I'm admittedly mystified by this, Andy. I want to start, though, with some of the testimony over the last few days. Hope Hicks, the former Trump aide, she took the stand. Her testimony was widely described as emotional. What do you think the actual impact of her testimony was, like the big takeaways?
Yeah, I really don't think, if you look at the just what the charges are in the indictment, I think her testimony is close to irrelevant. It's helpful to Trump in the sense that she said some things that would be helpful for him to argue that he wasn't concerned about the campaign finance laws. I doubt, actually, that Trump was even thinking about the campaign finance laws. What he was worried about is whether these alleged sexual relationships that he had, extramarital affairs in 2006, that the publicity about them, whether they happened or didn't, he denies they happened, that would be embarrassing for his family. And that was what he was focused on. And she gave some testimony that was helpful in that regard. But she had, you know, I thought the most telling thing, Guy, was the last question she was asked on last Friday afternoon, which is, when you were down in Washington working in the White House, did you have anything to do with the management and the keeping of the Trump Organization's business records 200-plus miles away in New York City? And she, of course, said she didn't. And the question was asked precisely because after 2 weeks of testimony, that was the first time any witness was asked about what the case is actually supposed to be about, which is, did Trump falsify his business records in 2017.
Right. And now we have Stormy Daniels and details coming out, sordid personal sexual allegations. Talk about this. I mean, it feels like what the prosecution, again, this is just my impression, what the prosecution wants to do is get 12, in their mind, hopefully Democrats like them, into a jury box and say, look at this guy, Donald Trump. You don't like him. We don't want him to win again. That's sort of the unstated part. He's not a good person. His character is bad. Let's not believe him on the affairs. And just trust us. There's a crime here. Let's just do the thing. That seems to be what they're, shorthand, what they're getting at here. Bad guy. We're going to tell you there's a crime. Just convict because, you know, gut instinct. We all know he's probably guilty of something. Maybe that's overstating things. but what else is the purpose of really going through in really gruesome detail some of the alleged sexual acts, for example?
There's no proper purpose in it. To remind your listeners, Guy, that the charge in the indictment is that Trump falsified his business records in 2017 fraudulently, Bragg says, to cover up his commission of another crime, which he alleges to be a federal campaign finance violation. Now, even if you credit Bragg's version of what happened here, whether or not Trump had a sexual encounter with Stormy Daniels is utterly irrelevant to the charges in the indictment, because whether he did or he didn't, what the case is about is how they booked his reimbursement of Michael Cohen for a $130,000 payment that Cohen undoubtedly, inarguably made to Stormy Daniels, which was for a non-disclosure agreement that silenced her and would have silenced her regardless of whether what she was saying was true or untrue. So the encounter is not relevant to the charges, and that, it's not enough to say that, because the testimony that came out today was basically a minute-by-minute description of how the sexual encounter occurred, where the only concession prosecutors made was that they wouldn't elicit testimony about her description of his genitalia. But everything else was fair game, and it was so bad that Judge Merchan, who allowed all of it to happen over the strenuous objections of Trump's lawyers, then sent the jury out of the room and admonished the prosecutors for doing what Merchan allowed them to do. So it's just – it's mind-boggling.
Why would he do that? Just to kind of make it seem like he's somewhat fair-minded? He knew what he was doing when he greenlit this.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, the reason he's doing it is it's so obvious to anybody who knows, you know, this neck of the woods, that commentators and appellate tribunals are going to look at this record and say, how did the judge let that in? And he'd rather have some seeds in the record that he's sown to say that maybe the prosecutors misled him. But I think you're exactly right. Everybody knew what she would say. This is not the first time.
This is Stormy Daniels herself, by the way, right?
Correct, Stormy Daniels, yes.
On the stand. And she said this publicly, and now she's saying it under oath. Could the argument maybe be, Andy, and I don't know how, you know, things are sometimes deemed, you know, relevant and pertinent or not based on a certain prosecution of the case or however the judge views things as being, you know, fair or not. But could the argument be that you need her on the stand to describe these sexual encounters because Trump insists that they didn't happen, and so to discredit his honesty and to impugn his credibility on other matters, you are proving to the jury that he's lying about the sex? Could that be the reason behind this?
That would be one argument in favor of it. The problem that the argument has, if you're going to follow the law accurately, is that when a question like that comes up, Guy, what a judge is supposed to do is weigh the probative value of the testimony against the potential prejudicial impact of it. And here, the government has a ton of evidence to go after Trump on his credibility, if that's what their intention is.
Well, and by the way, it won't. Can I just say, maybe there are Trump supporters out there who believe him when he says this didn't happen. But I think almost everyone absolutely believes that Donald Trump had sex with Stormy Daniels and then paid her not to talk about it because he paid her a huge sum of money that he would have no other reason in an NDA context to be giving someone of her line of work in the pornography industry. So, like, you can say, well, he's lying about this. It's like an obvious lie, a politician lying about sex, which I know we were told for a long time didn't matter if there was a D next to the name of the president, for example. But in this case, I think it's almost just stipulated by nearly everyone that this happened, which is why the payment happened in the first place. That is a completely different question than anything criminal happening, which right. seems like it should be the whole point of a criminal trial.
Yeah. See, Guy, the thing is, what you just articulated, the key part of that is everybody knows this happened. Nobody believes, Trump, that it didn't happen because the payment happened.
Right.
And the thing is, there's no dispute that the payment happened. And therefore, whether the sex happened or not is irrelevant because the question in the case is how they booked the payment.
Right.
And if
so, all the sexual details is it's all gratuitous for the
right.
purpose of getting the jury to be like, yeah, see, it's a bad guy. And you might say, hey, it's wrong to go have sex with a porn star and then pay her off with the hush money. A lot of people would be, you know, offended. Their values would not align with that, obviously. That is still, a bunch of sort of razzle-dazzle, look at this bad guy stuff in the context of what actually should be at issue in the trial, which is, were laws broken, let alone felony laws broken, and can you prove it? Because at least from where I sit as just a civilian following the trial somewhat closely, it seems like they haven't really come close to that yet. Let me ask you then, relatedly, I've heard a number of analysts talk about how there's like a second crime here that the prosecution hasn't even explicitly laid out yet. Is that correct? How is it possible for there to be a second crime, which would be essential to proving, you know, the larger case against Trump, if the public or the defense or everyone involved hasn't really been made aware of what it is yet? Is it being overly simplified, described that way? What's that about?
No, the way you've described it is accurate. And the reason people ask with wonder, you know, how is that possible, is because in the United States, under the Fifth Amendment, if they want to indict you, if the prosecutors want to indict you for a felony, they have to get an indictment from a grand jury with indication in the indictment that the grand jury found probable cause of every element of the crime, which means the indictment has to explain to you, put you on notice of exactly what it is the government has charged you with. And even more fundamentally, under New York constitutional law, a statute, if it's going to be used as a criminal statute, has to include all of the things that you need to do to be guilty under the statute. In other words, in New York, they don't allow what's called incorporation by reference. You're supposed to, in a statute, lay out everything that is necessary to put somebody on notice. So this is not supposed to happen in New York or America, but that's exactly what's happened. The indictment charges falsification of business records to commit another crime, but Bragg does not say what the other crime is. And he's hedged even to this point.
How is the defense supposed to defend against a crime that isn't being revealed by the people bringing the case?
The judge has allowed them to do it. What Bragg has said is the New York statute says another crime, which means any other crime I can think of can be the crime that Trump was trying to commit or conceal. And he says that he doesn't have to tell him what it is.
What?
He's got three different theories of what it could be. And what he hopes is that at the end, the jury will be instructed on those possibilities.
So he just, like, throws it out there like, well, it might be this other crime, or it might be that other crime, or maybe this other one. In your mind, yeah, whichever one it needs to stick to get to guilty, you just come up with that, jury. That is crazy. Is this one of the obvious grounds for appeal?
I think it's the most obvious ground for appeal. There are a number of other ones, but I think the indictment, as I said when it was returned, the indictment fails as an indictment. In the United States, an indictment is supposed to describe for the defendant what he's charged with, and the indictment in this case doesn't do that.
Are they violating Trump's constitutional rights here? Forget the gag order, which he's complaining about. He might have a fair point there. Are his constitutional rights as a defendant being violated just by what you've just described?
Yes, you have a right under the Fifth Amendment to be indicted by a grand jury. In other words, in our country, a prosecutor can't just sit down and write a charge against you and then take you to trial. They have to prove in the grand jury that there's probable cause of all the elements of a criminal offense.
Right, and then they've got to give it to you and to your counsel so you can defend yourself against the crimes that they're alleging that you've committed. But in this case, they're like keeping one of them secret, basically, for the purposes of this whole scheme. I am not a Trump defender reflexively. It is hard to look at this thing other than an absolute sham. From top to bottom, this case.
Yeah.
And it's the one that's going first, Andy, and we only have less than a minute left. All it takes is one juror, right, to say, enough, this is preposterous.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Guy. But I think to your point, this is why a lot of smart, honest Democrats have looked at this and said, this case is a joke, and it actually will help Trump undermine the more serious cases against him, because this, in the public mind, this is the face of lawfare.
Oh, well, what a way to start this Tuesday here on the Guy Benson Show. Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, current Fox News contributor with us. Andy, thank you.
Thanks, Guy.
So much to get to as we just rev our engines here. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Miss a minute, miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
I'm Guy Benson. Welcome back. We went slightly long there with Andy McCarthy at the top, but I think really worthwhile conversation. I mean, it's... those details are just staggering coming out of that trial. Meanwhile, here in Washington, D.C., at the Holocaust Museum, President Joe Biden giving remarks today about anti-Semitism and other related matters. I agreed with a number of things that he said, and I'm glad that he said them as president. He did include this in cut 8.
And my commitment to the safety of the Jewish people, the security of Israel, and its right to exist as an independent Jewish state is ironclad, even when we disagree.
Ironclad. I think some people might take issue with that, given really the policies of this administration and this president, even just this week. We'll get reaction from KT McFarland later, and Douglas Murray next on The Guy Benson Show.
Out of the gates and ready to go.
Hey, it's Hutton Withrow. Hot Mike is here on the Outkick Network. We've got your afternoon covered with the latest sports discussion, and it's available wherever you find your audio.
Daily analysis and news. He is hot. I am Mike. Actually, my name is Chad. His name is Jonathan. But you get the picture. We're going to bring it every single day. Whatever you want to call us, we'll respond to. We just want you to respond to what we're dishing out every day.
And while you're here, we hope you're subscribed to the podcast. Like, subscribe, and share.
New talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
Douglas Murray is a Fox News contributor, National Review Institute fellow, author, and just a very clear thinker. And we are pleased to have him back on the show. Douglas, good to have you here.
Very good to be with you, Guy.
I would like to play a few sound bites for you from MIT on campus yesterday up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They had a big to-do at one of these encampments, and things got very hostile. And these were some of the chants. For example, cut six. No Zionists on Boston streets, and then also cut seven. We are the Intifada. Long live the Intifada. Globalize the Intifada. If you can just, because I think some people have just gotten inured to this. They all chant things. They get in the streets. They say various things. They've been doing it for months. Just bring home for us and unpack the meaning behind chants like no Zionists on Boston streets and we are / long live / globalize the Intifada.
Well, the first thing is, of course, first of all, I mean, I'm not a Jew, but I'm a Zionist. I believe very firmly in the right of the Jewish people to determine their own future, defend themselves, and much more. Am I not welcome in Boston? I don't think so. Who the hell do these people think they are? They decide who can be on the streets or not. It's, I mean, these are people who need a very stern talking to, and we can just hope that they're as ignorant as they sound. As for the Intifada, I think everybody who chants there should be arrested for incitement to terrorism. They should also perhaps know what an intifada actually means. I assume these are more than kids who are shouting this. I suppose, what are they, 21, maybe 22? Some of the dimmer among them will be about 33 and still trying to finish their postgraduate degree in lesbian dance theory. But as they chant for intifada, they should know that the last time there was an intifada, the second intifada, followed the breakdown of the Oslo talks, in 2001, intifada looked something like this. The Palestinian man who walked to a nightclub called the Dolphinarium, the sort of nightclub that those students at MIT and elsewhere would like to go to themselves on a weekend if they took any time off their rabble-rousing. And the bomber went to the nightclub, noticed that there were large groups of young women about the age of these students standing outside trying to get into the packed Tel Aviv nightclub. And he detonated a bomb, killed dozens of young people, wounded dozens more for life. And that's their intifada. Their intifada is, for instance, a young Arab Muslim Israeli shot in the head, the stomach, and the neck by Palestinian jihadists in 2001 who thought he was a Jew. That's what intifada means. So if these people want it globalized, then if they were taken at their word, then they should expect a suicide bomber to come and blow them up and their fellow students, like a bomber did at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem in 2001 in the cafeteria. They want their intifada globalized. Okay, great. Do it at your own word. Wait for the suicide bomber to come into your cafe, your campus of MIT or Columbia or Berkeley, and just see how much you love intifada then.
I presume some of them have no idea what it means, and it sounds exciting and somewhat, you know, foreign and mysterious and dangerous, so they're kind of excited by that, and it's almost romanticized to them. It's exotic. Ooh, okay, intifada, this is what they're telling us to chant. We'll just repeat it back. That's some of them. Others, I'm sure, absolutely know what it means, and they're for it. They just assume they would be spared. They wouldn't be the ones killed. It would be Jews, right, especially the Zionist Jews. They'd be the ones killed, and maybe some other Zionists like you and me, but they would be spared from an intifada. Maybe they'd be the ones partaking in the intifada. It's hard to kind of absolve them of that, isn't it?
Well, all of these people fall into two categories, the sinister and the silly. The sinister are the ones who actually do love this. They love the fact that clearly that American students were killed at the university in Jerusalem in 2001 at the cafeteria suicide bombing. Presumably they love that. So these are people who love the murder and mutilation of American students their own age. So those are the really sinister ones, that we're very unlucky to have such sick and deranged people on our campuses or on our streets. But as for the silly, how incredibly ridiculous, stupid, and mentally impaired do you have to be to shout something you don't know what it even means? I mean, you know, I reckon I'm quite a bright guy. You're a bright guy. If we were at an American campus and somebody just started chanting some word we didn't know, would we join in? No. Would we ask what a word meant before we chanted it?
I'd be Googling. Be Googling on my phone.
So.
Yeah.
I reckon I'd have a quick look beforehand at exactly what it was. So how incredibly dumb do these silly students have to be? What ghouls they are, what ill-educated ghouls they are, that they stand on campus and shout words they don't understand. They have no right to be on a campus if they're that stupid. Nobody with any cognitive ability goes around shouting slogans they don't understand. So I find the silly to be just as problematic, to use one of their favorite words, as the sinister.
The clips we played for you were from Boston or Greater Boston, MIT. Then yesterday in New York, you had some other charming scenes. Some of these people tried to disrupt the Met Gala. And in the process, well, here in Cut 5 were a number of young women in the full Muslim headscarves chanting at the police, Cut 5. Oink, oink, piggy, piggy, talking to the police, we will make your lives, and then a word that we can't use. Doesn't quite rhyme, but, you know, they can only do so well. That is one scene, a handful of them. There was another scene nearby, a war memorial, a memorial to our war dead, where they desecrated it with spray paint, with Palestinian garb and flags, and they also burned an American flag in front of it. Douglas, I know some people say, look, even if we support Israel, Guy, you're talking about this a lot, it goes so much deeper than Israel. It goes so much deeper than the well-being of Jews. Those are both extremely important to me. But it's about people who hate our civilization, hate our law enforcement, hate what should be sacred to this country, our veterans, our war dead, our flag. I think that's something that instinctively gets a rise out of so many Americans, including some of the people leading the backlash on some of these campuses.
Yes. I mean, what everybody needs to realize is that Israel is now, as it has been for many years since the global left decided to adopt it as their bogeyman, Israel is just simply the first country in the sights of these maniacs. But it's always here in America that their sights really are. You know, they attack Israel for being colonialist. Israel's never had a colony. It was founded in 1948, and they don't know what they're even talking about. But they say colonialist about Israel because they want to say colonialist about America. They claim that Israel is some kind of white supremacist society, and I'd invite them to go to Israel any day, and they'll see that that's not accurate, not just not white supremacist, but not white, an incredibly diverse population. But they want to say white supremacist about Israel in order to say it about America next. And they want to ban the Star of David. They want to burn the Star of David in order to burn the flag of the United States of America next. They want to insult the Israeli people and the Israeli army, and they want to attack and insult the American police and the American army, including the American war dead next. they really show us what they are, these people. They really show us, and they show it again and again. Anyone who thinks this is Israel's problem is kidding themselves. It's a Western civilization problem. It's a problem for civilization as a whole. And the problem that we see here clearly now is a generation of students, some of whom have been indoctrinated not only into stupidity, but into wickedness, a wicked, unforgivable stupidity. Thankfully, there are some people, including some students, who are brave enough to push back against that. And God bless them. God bless the students who are waving American flags and hanging American flags up instead of the jihadist flags that the students are currently playing with. And all these cosplay kids dressing up as Palestinian terrorists. Thank goodness there are some smart, clever, far smarter, far cleverer American students who are also patriots who recognize what this these would-be jihadists and these cosplay jihadists are and are pushing back at them.
I think even if they're not steeped in the history of the conflict, which, of course, neither are these cosplayers, they don't know what they're talking about, they're deeply ignorant, but the people on the other side say, we see what they're doing to statues of George Washington, for example, what they're doing to our flag, the things that they're chanting. We know deep in our bones we're against that. That's wrong. They're against what we stand for. And they're pushing back, I think, in a really admirable way. Douglas Murray, thank you so much for your time. We always appreciate it on the Guy Benson
Great
Show.
Great pleasure.
Back here on the Guy Benson Show, one of the least talented politicians of major profile in the United States, I would argue, is Kathy Hochul. She's the Democrat governor of New York, who narrowly won re-election in 2022. She had a good opponent, Lee Zeldin, who ran a strong race, but still such a blue state, and she won by, what was it, mid-single digits? She's not good at this. I think to her 180 on immigration, where she was like, you know, quoting the Statue of Liberty poem and saying, oh, all the migrants are welcome here, we'll show them what New Yorkers are really about and all of that, come one, come all type thing, and then things got really ugly in New York and have been ever since. And it's been a huge fiscal strain. There's been crime and all of that. And then she's like, you know what? On second thought, no, we're closed. We're closed. Go somewhere else. Can we get some one-way bus tickets and plane tickets out of here? Can I ship them up to Canada, maybe? All of these backpedaling moves by a governor who's awful. Like, she couldn't foresee the problem, so she invited it. And now she's trying to run away from it like she had nothing to do. Just not good. Not good at the job on substance, also not good at communicating. Which brings us to what she said this week. She was out on the other coast. She was in California. Maybe she was like getting some tips on how to fail worse. So she went to California. And she had something to say about equity and diversity, because this was the thrust of her remarks. She was talking about the importance of diversity and equity, and in order to underscore in her mind the need for more government intervention in pursuit of equity and diversity and, you know, fill in the buzzword, she just really demeaned the intelligence and life experience of a huge number of children in New York. And again, she thinks that she is doing, like, good racial pandering here, making a point as a good white liberal about how tough black people have it. Instead, it's just, like, a slap in the face and pretty racist. Cut 21.
Young black kids growing up in the Bronx who don't even know what the word computer is. They don't know. They don't know these things. And I want the world open up to all of them, because when you have their diverse voices innovating solutions through technology, then you're really addressing society's broader challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, she's just a good white lady, liberal, progressive white lady, who wants to help all those black kids through diversity, because otherwise they just have no idea what the word computer even means. Poor little children. poor little ignorant, stupid, clueless children. They need Kathy's help. Every kid who's been born in, what, the last how many decades knows what a computer is. What entered her mind to use that example? It's just so unbelievably, like, patronizing. Like, oh, these black kids in the Bronx, they need my help and the government's diversity efforts, or else these ignorant dum-dums don't even know what a computer is. Isn't that sad? Isn't that sad, you guys? Obviously, this did not go over very well with the people in those communities who were like, what the hell are you talking about? New York Post reporting on this. Bronx politicians ripped Governor Kathy Hochul after she asserted that some black children in the borough don't know what the word computer means. She was speaking on stage at a forum, as I mentioned, in California, and she stuck her foot in her mouth while trying to explain how she wants to create a diverse workforce in new areas, like AI. Then they quote what you just heard there. Lawmakers from the Bronx and all across the five boroughs quickly tore into Hochul's gaffe, which she later said she regretted. Do better, Assemblywoman Karines Reyes, Democrat from the Bronx, wrote on X, saying she was deeply disturbed by Hochul's remarks. Quote, our children are bright, brilliant, extremely capable, and more than deserving of any opportunities that are extended to other kids, Reyes added. And you've got John Zaccaro, a Democrat from the Bronx. Our children, far from being underestimated, are the epitome of brilliance, resilience, and untapped potential. Then they all continue, sort of laying it on thick about how great the kids are. That was, I think, their way of getting some pot shots in at a governor who is, it's no secret, not terribly popular or revered within her own party. This was an opportunity not only to stand up for the community for a lot of these folks, but also take absolutely free pot shots at Hochul because there's nothing she can say. That was an example of ignorant kids that went into her head and came out of her mouth. I'm not going to sit here and say she's a racist. I am going to say that is not a smart way to communicate, but that's very on brand for her. It also reminds me of the time that Joe Biden, our president, said, quote, poor kids are just as bright and just as talented as white kids. Ugh. Another cringe moment from another good, bien pensant, white, progressive Democrat. Another hour of the Guy Benson Show. Straight ahead, keep it right here.
A new generation of conservative talk. Right here, right now. Fair, fun, and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News. Fox News. You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It is a brand new hour here on The Guy Benson Show. Thanks so much for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com. That's our website. The podcast is always free. It's always on demand as soon as the show is over every weekday. GuyBensonShow.com or FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm doing the show from D.C. today, then taking it on the road the rest of the week to one of the more far-flung places we've ever broadcasted from. More details on that tomorrow. Looking forward to it. We will talk to you then. In the meantime, lots of shows still to get to today on this Tuesday. And I want to begin this hour by doing a little bit of a deep dive into some election data that I find very interesting. And most of this that I'm about to tell you, I think, is cause for serious concern among the Biden team and the Democrats. However, there will be a caveat, at this point a somewhat familiar one to this audience, that cuts in the other direction. We'll get to that, but let's begin with the main source of what I'm talking about, which is an analysis done by the Brookings Institution, which is a left-leaning, nonprofit sort of think tank here in D.C. And I wrote about this today at townhall.com, where I'm political editor. And actually going and reading my piece and looking at the chart that I'm going to describe will probably make this a lot easier. Because using words over radio to explain an intricate chart is a challenge. When you're looking at it, it's a lot easier. So it's right there in my post today at townhall.com. It's easy to find. You can Google my name, etc. But I will do my best as well here in this forum, within this medium, to explain why I think this is so significant. And to some extent, it's just obvious. It jumps right off the page at you. The Brookings Institution looked at Pew data from exit polls in the 2020 election, and then the latest Pew Research national survey of this year's presidential race. And let's just stipulate, and I'll probably revisit this, but let's just stipulate these are not apples to apples comparisons. Because post-election analyses of exit polls, which actually talk to real voters who actually cast their ballots, that is different than projecting ahead to an upcoming election when you're not really sure what the electorate is going to look like. Right? Breaking down who voted and how they voted after the fact is much more concrete than trying to predict what will happen in the future. That being said, given the way that the 2020 election happened and in the middle of a pandemic and a lot of people mailing in ballots, the traditional exit polling methods were tweaked to involve some, I would say, processes and methods that are closer to traditional political polling than old school exit polling, if that makes sense. So again, not making a perfect parallel to post-election data about what just happened versus 2024 predictive polling, still months away from the actual election itself. But I think some of the themes, some of the trends, some of the trajectories are very much worth considering. And they also reflect what we're seeing in other polls as well, which is why Team Biden, Team Blue, I think, collectively, they're nervous. They're nervous about November. Not totally panicked. Biden isn't cooked. It's not like there's no way he can win. I think he absolutely can win for a number of reasons. But the idea that he is a favorite right now, I don't think so. I think at best for him, it's a jump ball. And in more likelihood, Trump is the slight favorite at the moment. And here's why. So it was roughly 51-47 percentage-wise Biden over Trump in 2020 in the national popular vote. So Biden won roughly by 4 points. That's the result from last time. Looking ahead to this time, Pew has Trump ahead by 1 point. And this was from late last month. So that would be a shift to the right, a red shift, let's call it, of 5 points. Then you start to look at some of the key demographics that represent the victory coalition for Democrats. For example, like men favored Trump in 2020, barely. Now they favor him by more. Women, much more important to the Democratic game plan, right? Their path to victory runs through women. Joe Biden beat Donald Trump by 11 points, according to this Pew data, in 2020. So it was 55% for Biden, 44% for Trump, an 11-point double-digit win for Biden. Right now, Biden is only up by 3 in the Pew polling against Trump. So that would be a red shift, let's call it, of 8 points, right? From plus 11 to plus 3, that's an 8-point movement in this data towards Trump. That's among women. A lot has been made about people of color, racial minorities. Is that reflected in this data? The answer is resoundingly yes. So among Hispanics, Biden beat Trump by 21 points in 2020. 59% for Biden, 38% for Trump. That was 4 years ago. So a 21-point margin for Biden among Hispanic voters. Again, I'm using the Pew exit polling data that they published in 2021. In the new poll, also from Pew, it is now an 8-point lead for Biden, 52-44. So that's a 21-point win last time to just an 8-point lead right now in this data. That is a 13-point swing towards Trump, a red shift of 13 points in the Pew data among Hispanics. What about Asian Americans, an emerging voting bloc? It was a blowout for Joe Biden last time. 72% for Biden, just 28% for Trump. A 44-point margin among Asians. Right now, still a double-digit lead for Biden, 59-36, but that's just a 23-point lead, meaning a red shift of 21 points, a double-digit red shift among Asians, just like there was a double-digit red shift among Hispanics. And then what about Black Americans? 92% of them in the Pew data went for Biden, 8% for Trump. An 84-point margin for Joe Biden, 84-point margin. Is Trump really cutting into that? The answer is yes. In the latest Pew numbers, Trump is up to 18%. Biden is down in the high 70s. That is a 25-point red shift toward Donald Trump among Black voters, looking at the Pew data that I'm quoting. So you add that all up, Hispanics, Asians, Black Americans, based on this graphic, based on this data, which is mined from Pew and then analyzed and synthesized by the left-leaning Brookings Institution, you have double-digit red shifts across all three of those racial groups. Now, when you're sort of squinting at this big block of information and all the little blue and red bars and all the numbers, and you try to find good news for Joe Biden, two data points stick out because you've got a little blue graph that looks like he's made some gains, some maybe substantial gains in two groups. And let me just give you the spoiler alert, the punchline ahead of time. These are typos. So the best news for Joe Biden, quote unquote, best news for Joe Biden in this whole chart, the two pieces of information that might be good news for him are actually reversed by accident. Human error, they actually are good numbers for Trump. They just put the wrong color in, blue instead of red. Let me explain. So among Hispanics without a college degree, it looks like Biden has actually gained 7 points. So there's been a blue shift towards Biden among Hispanics, no college degree. Actually, they just messed up the math. Yes, there was a 7-point shift, but it was a red shift. They just got it wrong on the infographic. And then this one fascinates me because maybe it's a little bit myopic and a little selfish, but my age range. So let's call it roughly millennials. It's not perfect, but roughly millennials aged 30 to 49. In 2020, that was a double-digit win for Joe Biden, 55 to 43% against Donald Trump. So plus 11 or plus 12 among my age group, 30 to 49. And you have a lot of people through the years saying, gosh, are the millennials ever going to start to move right as they get older, as previous generations had done? That had not been the case for a while. There are now signs that it's happening, perhaps belatedly, including this one. So Biden carried that demo by 12 points last time in the Pew data. In the new Pew poll, among that age group, voters 30 to 49, Trump is ahead by 2 points, 50 to 48 over Biden. And they've accidentally at Brookings, again, made the same error where they've made it a 13-point blue shift, and the bar actually should be red. So I'll reiterate, the two best pieces of news in this whole big infographic with tons of numbers on it and sort of the bars of red and blue showing these shifts between last election and this election, the two best-looking blue pops on the infographic are typos, are user error on Brookings' part. They're actually bad news for Biden and good news for Trump. I mean, a double-digit swing among millennials, that age group, towards Trump. I think part of that has to do with millennials not just growing up and trying to buy houses and feeling like things are unaffordable, and then finally maybe they're getting their lives together, then they get hit by this pandemic, then inflation just hammers them. We're mad. I think understandably mad. We had the huge financial crisis in 2008 that disrupted, you know, college, post-college for a lot of us. And then everything got delayed a bit, starting a family, starting a life the way we had imagined, and then inflation is taking such a big bite out of that. I think that there is, frankly, some resentment about Gen Z and all the nonsense that we see all the time on campuses. I think some of us collectively might be growing up and saying, all right, that's garbage. We don't want to be associated with that, and being sort of repulsed by that and therefore driven rightward. And, I mean, look, when you're trying to create a life and build wealth and you're failing and you're slipping and the government seems to be causing a lot of the problems and prices for everything going up, you can remember some of the momentum that you might have been feeling back in 2017, 2018, 2019 when a certain somebody else was president. Which might explain, and look, we'll see. We're so far off. All the caveats apply. All the asterisks. We're 6 months away from the election. So many events are going to intervene. Who knows where the campaign is going? But there's been a lot of stability in this horse race because it's a rematch of two presidents and everyone has feelings about them. I've said this before. So that's why it's not a waste of my breath here to be, I think, doing a deep dive like this and talking about it. With, of course, the humility of knowing that this could all be moot at some point down the line if major things change, but there just haven't been tectonic shifts. There have been potentially seismic events that have barely been a blip in terms of public opinion. So if you see a double-digit swing among 30 to 49-year-olds towards Trump, and double-digit swings among two or three racial minority groups, as this Pew data suggests, and a move towards Trump among women, whether it's just a few points or 8 to 10 points, that is a deep erosion of the Biden victory coalition. And yes, remember, he won. He won 81 million votes. He won by 4 percentage points fairly comfortably in the national numbers, but he won the presidency pretty narrowly. When you add it all together, it's tens of thousands of votes in a handful of states that if they had gone just the other way, Trump would have been reelected even in spite of everything. So without big shifts away from Trump among his base, but real erosion and sort of a loss of altitude with Biden among key pieces of the groups that made him president in 2020, you put that all together sort of into the computer of your brain, just basic common sense, and you say, that is going to be a tough re-election road for Biden this time. Even if these numbers are approximately correct, they don't have to be perfect, approximately correct, that victory coalition is in real jeopardy for Biden, which is why I think you're seeing so much of the frantic pandering that you're seeing from this guy and his team. So that is the good news, and there's a lot of it there for Trump, and it's backed up by a lot of other polling. And absolutely, that's nothing to sneeze at. That's a lot of good news for Trump. You might be thinking, seems unvarnished to me. Well, there's another side of it, and I have to explain that as soon as we come back. It's important. Stay tuned.
Not the same talking points here. The Guy Benson Show.
I'm Guy Benson. We are back. We just sunk our teeth into a lot of data that looks quite good for Donald Trump, his position much stronger than it was 4 years ago. That's all real. However, this is the other shoe to drop. This is where Biden and the Democrats have a real advantage. ABC has a new poll out that I think underscores a point that I've been making and trying to beat the drum loud enough for people to actually pay attention. In the ABC News poll, among adults in the United States, Donald Trump is beating Joe Biden by 2 points. Among registered voters, it's tied. It's like a 1 point difference. Among likely voters, reliable likely voters, Joe Biden is up by 4 points. New York Times had a big story about all the get out the vote, getting ballots into voters' hands efforts that the Democrats are undertaking with field offices in all these swing states. They're building a ground game army. Because elections, yes, it's about ideas and policies and popularity and top-level messaging, but it's also about, it's really ultimately about, who shows up with a ballot, drops it into the box, wherever it might be, and submits it. What is the universe of people that actually show up and participate? And the Democrats are doing everything in their power to have an absolute well-oiled machine on the ballot front. And that's what could be the difference between winning and losing. I keep saying, you look at the polling, Biden is up among people who are definitely going to vote. Among people who sometimes vote, Trump is up big. Among people who aren't registered but could be, Trump is up bigger. You'd say, well, that's great. Trump could win by a landslide even, or at least a comfortable margin if those people show up for him. But that won't happen by magic. The Republicans in the Trump campaign have to get those people out, and they are way behind in that operation and that game behind the Democrats who have been perfecting this. They are way behind. That is the biggest positive piece of information that Biden has going for him, despite everything else that I just mentioned. And ABC News is just the latest in a whole conga line of surveys that prove Biden has the advantage among the likeliest, most reliable voters. Can the Republicans get their act together and mobilize this other universe of voters? If they can, I think Trump has a very good chance of winning. If they can't, the country might not be happy about it mood-wise, but the Democrats might just crank out a victory, churning their machine. The Guy Benson Show continues with more right after this break. Please stay tuned.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
Halfway through the Guy Benson Show, thanks for tuning in. With us now is Byron York, chief political correspondent at the Washington Examiner and a Fox News contributor. Byron, hello.
Hi, Guy. Good to be here.
So we had Andy McCarthy at the top of the show giving his legal analysis of the Trump trial in New York. Of course, Andy, a longtime federal prosecutor. Neither one of us are lawyers here, Byron, but we follow politics very closely. And to me, this is really almost all about politics, less about the law. That's what's happening in Manhattan, in my view. Many Americans, even non-Trump fans, it seems, agree to a large extent. So on that score, I do want to ask you about how you are viewing this saga so far, this whole performance, because we're now weeks in, and apparently we might be getting a few more weeks of this before everyone rests.
Yeah, well, first of all, it is dominating news in the way that we thought that it would. It's not the only story. There have been lots of campus protests. There's continuing Israel-Hamas war. But this really has been dominating a lot of news coverage, even though there are no cameras in the courtroom. You know, the cable networks have come up with ways to have reporters in there in an overflow room texting what's being said, and then they put the text on the screen, and it's a very old-fashioned kind of way of doing things. So it has really dominated. My sense is the injustice of the charges against Trump, for which he faces a maximum of 136 years in prison, I'm serious.
It's just crazy.
It's 34 felonies, each with a potential 4 years in prison. It's for bookkeeping. And I think this is coming out some. I've been watching coverage today of the Stormy Daniels testimony, and we've seen all this before. And I think it's really coming out that this is kind of a made-up offense that never should have been brought. The charges never should have been brought.
And by the way, just let me jump in because, you know, they got Al Capone on bookkeeping, right, because it was massive tax evasion.
No, they got him on tax evasion. He actually didn't pay his taxes for a number of years.
Exactly. So that's my point. Like, the bookkeeping problem, and they had the bookkeeper in the movie The Untouchables come out and sort of hang him on that charge because they couldn't get him on the other stuff. That was tax evasion. That is a very clear-cut crime. Whereas this, yes, there's a bookkeeping component, but they're saying, well, it was hush money to this mistress, and it's all very unseemly, of course, but major political and famous figures pay hush money settlements. There are NDAs. It's part of that universe. And sometimes people don't write on their books, here's the porn star payoff. They kind of call it something else. That is supposedly the offense here that they've blown up into dozens of felonies. It's just
Actually, Trump's bookkeeper testified that they had to find somebody to categorize these payments they were making to Michael Cohen. And they had a drop-down menu. They have kind of an old computer system in the drop-down menu, and you have like five choices to categorize these payments, and one of them is legal services. Now, they're paying for a non-disclosure agreement negotiated by a lawyer, and they call it legal expenses. And that is the heart of the crime here. And, of course, you know, the second it has to have a second crime to be a felony. They still haven't revealed, prosecutors still haven't revealed exactly what that is. We now think it's a violation of the Federal Election Campaign Act, that 1971 act that set up the FEC and the whole campaign law structure.
Which the feds haven't pursued, right? The feds didn't pursue that.
No, the FEC did not pursue this. Nor did the Justice Department pursue this. And we know also, neither did the Manhattan District Attorney until Alvin Bragg became the District Attorney, having campaigned on pledges to get Donald Trump. So I think what we're seeing is, you asked me about politics. The trial started on March the 15th. April 15th. So it's in its fourth week. We're now actually seeing a number of polls that have been taken while the trial was underway and while this wall-to-wall media coverage was underway. And it doesn't seem to have affected anything. Now, maybe if Trump's found guilty, and he could be found guilty on all the charges for all I know, maybe that'll make a big difference. But right now, you know, you and I have talked in the past, well, would these indictments make any difference? Well, no, they didn't. Actually, they may have helped him in the Republican race. Well, what about the trials? Will the trials make any difference? Well, right now we're having a trial. Doesn't seem to have made any difference. So the next question is, would a conviction make any difference? And in this case, with these facts, I'm not sure that it would.
I want to come back to that in a second. But before we do, would the gag order battle back and forth that seems to be fueling a lot of the drama and the breathless reporting out of the courthouse, and Trump's been fined again, and this judge, who, by the way, donated to Joe Biden and his daughter's raising a ton of money for Democrats, this judge has now threatened, I'm getting tired of all these fines. You might be incarcerated if you keep, you know, blowing through the gag order and talking about this trial publicly. I posed this to Senator Shelley Moore Capito yesterday, knowing Trump, Byron, knowing how he operates politically, knowing how he enjoys getting and keeping attention, is there any part of you that thinks that Trump might want to dare this judge to put him in jail for a night?
No, I don't think he wants to go to jail. I mean, I think Trump is mortified at having been indicted four times. If you go to his rallies, listen to his speeches, he almost always talks about having been indicted all these times and being indicted more times than Al Capone, we were talking earlier. He says he imagines his late parents looking down on him saying, how did our son get indicted more times than Al Capone? So, no, I think he hates this. I think he's mortified by it, and I do not think that he wants to go to jail. As a matter of fact, yesterday, which was the big day of talking about the gag thing, when he came out, when he arrived in court in the morning, made his statement, I thought it was pretty carefully worded so as not to set off any gag order problems.
Yeah, I think it would be such an awful look. The whole trial is insane overreach in my mind. So to then actually put the guy behind bars could actually benefit him. I can't imagine anyone wants to spend any time in jail. I don't doubt that, but I do wonder if there's just a little bit of gamesmanship there saying, okay, Your Honor, are you really going to do this? Biden donor, it would take the whiff of Banana Republic politics and turn it into a full-blown stench. And even to a lot of voters who may not be paying attention saying, really? Now, you were posing this question, Byron, a moment ago about whether a conviction might change things. And it might matter which case we're talking about. This is the one in front of us. This is the one that's underway right now. Unclear if any of the other ones will actually transpire prior to the election. So just looking at the proceedings now, one of the ways that the prosecution, i.e. Bragg, might get a conviction is through not just a heavily slanted jury from a very blue jurisdiction, but also by getting an assist from the aforementioned Biden donor judge, not allowing the Trump defense to bring compelling witnesses with compelling testimony to the fore to offer certain facts to the jury. So the jury may not hear things that at least seem to be very relevant in my mind. You wrote about one of these examples, since you also name-checked the FEC earlier. So this is a consequential, again, anti-Trump decision by this anti-Trump judge about not just a pertinent matter in my mind, maybe the pertinent matter. Byron York, I want to get into those details about the column you've written on all of this. Highly significant stuff. We'll do that as soon as we come back from this very short break on The Guy Benson Show.
In the swamp, not of the swamp. Guy Benson.
Back here on The Guy Benson Show with Byron York. And Byron, we were just teasing this before the break. I would like you to talk about the Trump defense witness that they want to bring and how he is being at least partially muzzled in advance by this judge.
He's a man named Brad Smith. George W. Bush appointed him to the Federal Election Commission. He was the chairman of the Federal Election Commission. There was a huge fight over his nomination because he was opposed to Democratic-style campaign finance reform and believed that a lot of our campaign finance structure was unnecessary. But anyway, former chairman knows about as much as you can know about campaign finance, and he has strong opinions, which are backed up by a bunch of legal decisions, about what constitutes something that is done for the purpose of influencing an election. Now, as you know, all of the breathless media coverage of the Stormy Daniels trial has said that Trump was trying to corrupt the election, he was trying to influence the election, he was trying to fix the election, all of these things. And Brad Smith would say, and he said this back when Michael Cohen first got in trouble in 2018, said, look, not every expense that a candidate pays is done for the purpose of influencing an election legally. Let's say he's a businessman. He has a few lawsuits against him. He's going to run for office. He knows he's going to run for office. So what he does is he settles the lawsuits to kind of get those off the table, out of the picture before he announces his candidacy. Is that an election? I mean, that's done for the purpose of making him a better candidate. It's not an election expense. Let's say he's the same man. He's in his 60s and he's never run for office before. And his wife says, well, you know, your face is getting kind of jowly. Maybe you could get a little work done, you know, before you run for office. So he goes and he has plastic surgery. That is not an expense for the purpose of influencing an election. And in the case of the Stormy Daniels payoff, we have already gotten testimony that Trump, I'll use the word mortified again, was very unhappy and about the idea of Daniels story coming out and his wife finding out about it. So much so that when it was reported in the Wall Street Journal, Hope Hicks said that he tried to make sure that day that the Wall Street Journal was not delivered to his wife. So there are multiple reasons beyond the election for Trump not to want this story to come out, which means this is simply not a campaign finance matter.
Which is the whole crux of this alleged crime.
The second crime, apart from the first crime, is just false record keeping, which is a misdemeanor whose statute of limitations expired in 2019. Okay, it's over. 5 years passed, out of date. You could never bring that case. So to be able to bring
it, they would never bring the case anyway.
Of course you wouldn't.
It's not a
misdemeanor.
Thing.
And so now they've come up with a second crime, which, by the way, is also a misdemeanor. To turn this all into a felony that Trump was should have disclosed this payment to the FEC on his campaign finance reports, where apparently there is a category that says hush money, and you check that and you write $130,000 next to it. So Brad Smith, former chairman of the FEC, is saying, look, this is baloney. This is not the way it works. It's the law doesn't require it. There's been a lot of legal cases about this. There was this John Edwards case where the Justice Department tried to enforce something like this against John Edwards and lost. They had to give up. So the Trump people want to call Brad Smith as a witness, and they're going to. But Judge Marchand has forbidden Smith from saying a lot of what I was just talking about.
He's forbidden on what, Smith on what from grounds?
Talking. He said it's probative of nothing. The fact that the FEC looked into this matter and took no action, and the Justice Department looked into this matter and took no action, Smith cannot mention that. He's been forbidden from mentioning that because the judge said it was, quote, probative of nothing. Smith cannot talk about.
By the way, can I just jump in? I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an expert. I'm just trying to figure out on what planet that would be probative of nothing. It's like disproving the core of the state's case.
It's Planet Marchand. I mean, I don't know. But that's what the judge said. So the jury will never hear this from Brad Smith. And as a matter of fact, Marchand said that Smith could only testify about, you know, the nature of the FEC and what kind of law it enforces and all this kind of general stuff, like, you know, what floor of the building is the FEC located on? And to try to keep Smith from addressing the actual issues in the trial. So I kind of came to the conclusion that Donald Trump is not the only person under a gag order in this case, because one of his strongest potential witnesses, Brad Smith, faces the same kind of speech restrictions from Judge Marchand.
Because this guy literally ran the Federal Elections Commission. He was the chairman of the FEC, and a big part of the prosecution's case here is, oh, what Trump did ran afoul of SEC regulations, yep, and therefore that's another element of the crime that we're going to then parlay into dozens of felonies with, you know, 100-plus years of jail time attached to it or prison time. And here's the chairman of the FEC,
yes,
who wants to come in and tell the jury, actually, no, that's not how this works, and actually,
yes,
no, this expense doesn't fall into that category.
Right.
And the judge is saying, oh, yeah, the jury can never hear about that. That when Trump, and look, this audience knows, and I hear from them sometimes, and they get frustrated with me when I'm critical of Trump, certain people in the audience. I try to call them the way that I see them. When Trump yells about things being rigged, sometimes he's wrong and conspiratorial and myopic. Sometimes he's right. And this feels and looks very much like a rigged trial to me, Byron. Is that overstating it?
No, I don't think it's overstating it. That's why the polite way to say it is there are going to be a lot of issues for appeal.
But as I keep saying, the appeal doesn't matter. They're happy to lose on appeal. This is about a utilitarian outcome in the next 6 months. This is
exactly
about attaching a label to Donald Trump before the election in November. That's it. If they lose down the line, they don't care. This is not about justice or enforcing the law. This is about winning an election.
You are so correct. And if every decision that Judge Marchand makes and even the jury makes is overturned on appeal, there's no way it would happen before the election, and you're absolutely right. The whole idea is to be able to call Donald Trump a convicted felon. And you and I were just mentioned it briefly. There are polls in which people who currently now support Trump or are open to supporting Trump who say they would not support Trump
right.
if he were convicted of a felony.
Right, or they would second guess it.
That's what they're going after right there.
100%. And just sort of casting our minds ahead to the future, days, weeks, if this jury comes back with a not guilty or a hung jury, despite the rigging of the trial, that would really be something, because they are doing everything between Bragg and this judge, both partisan Democrats. They are doing everything they can to guarantee that convicted felon label. We shall see. Byron York, thanks so much for your time. Final hour of the program is next. KT McFarland on foreign policy when we return.
Raise your glass.
to the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. Brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
It's the Happy Hour on the Guy Benson Show, Tuesday edition. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com, our online home. Lots of content there, lots of goodies. You can also follow me on social media at Guy P. Benson on Twitter and on Instagram. Follow the show, both places, at Guy Benson Show. The podcast is free on demand when the show is over. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Taking the show on the road the rest of the week to a very far-flung location. Far, far away. We'll tell you more about that tomorrow. This hour is sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink, no matter where we are. We love the long drink. It is delicious. It is refreshing. 21 plus only because it's an alcoholic beverage. We always urge you to drink responsibly, of course. TheLongDrink.com. TheLongDrink.com. You can find out where they're sold near you. They've really expanded. They are doing gangbusters. You can also order online, thelongdrink.com. With me now is Katie McFarland, former Trump Deputy National Security Advisor. She has served under four different presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Trump. Katie, it's great to talk to you.
Well, it's always an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we were able to see each other for about 4 seconds yesterday in New York. I was racing from one studio to another with, like, no time in between my hits. So I felt like I shortchanged our exchange and our interaction. So I apologize for that. But even for 4 seconds, it was very good to see you.
Well, it's, you know, you're a busy guy, and it makes a lot of sense because you're a really smart guy. And you, I must say, the observations you have, particularly about American politics, you're out there by yourself. You know, you're not just repeating what everybody else says. You really come at things with a very unique angle and quite profound. So good for you.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. I would ask you to go on, but I want to pick your brain here. So that does mean a lot, though, especially someone with your knowledge, your expertise, your experience. That's really extremely flattering and very kind of you to say. So thank you. Let's talk about Israel, Gaza, Rafah specifically. Katie, maybe I am missing something. I'm just wondering, can you recall any time in modern American history or American history generally where a president of the United States is saying with one side of his mouth that he has ironclad commitment to a top American ally, and out of the other side of his mouth, he is doing seemingly everything possible to undermine that ally and to basically short-circuit that ally's ability to do something militarily that other country is trying to achieve? Because that is what he is doing with the Israelis right now, in my mind, no question about it. Have you ever seen anything like that?
No, and remember, this is not about what's best for Israel or what's even best for the United States. It's what's best for Joe Biden, and how does he get reelected? And he figures he's going to play both sides because he needs the Muslim American votes from a couple of key states in the Midwest. All the people who are shouting death to America, death to Israel, kill all the Jews, they're helping determine his foreign policy. And so he has to appease them, and therefore he has to look like he's going against Israel. But on the other hand, you know, Israel is one of America's long-term allies in the region and a close friend, and he can't really abandon Israel, so he's got to look like he's supporting Israel. So he's trying to have it both ways. And at the end of the day, he has it no ways because, you know, I just keep thinking of what Barack Obama said when President Obama said about Joe Biden. He said, never underestimate Joe Biden's ability to screw things up. And the situation in Gaza and Hamas and Israel, the solution would have been so easy if Biden had just had a little bit of courage. If he had just gone to the Israelis and said, look, you're going to be able to do it. You've got to clear out Gaza, you got to destroy Hamas, and here's how we're going to do it. And he could have gone to the Palestinians and said, okay, the civilians and the Palestinians, you know, you're not all Hamas. We're going to help you get out of we're going to help you get out of Gaza, go into the Sinai, go into Egypt, stay there temporarily while Israel goes and cleans out Hamas, destroys the tunnels. And then once Gaza is Hamas free, they could have let the Palestinians back in. But no, as you've described it, he's just sort of screwed everything up. And now Israel has no choice. It has to go after Hamas and Rafah, and it's going to take a while. It's going to be a lot of civilian casualties. And Hamas thinks it's already won. I mean, Hamas thinks it's won no matter what. Hamas thinks it's won if Israel doesn't go in, because then Hamas can regroup, rebuild, reattack.
Survive.
And Hamas thinks it's won if Israel does go in, because there will be a lot of civilian casualties because of the way Hamas uses its own women and children as human shields. And then Israel loses world approval.
Yeah. And at least you would be Hamas-free at that point. That's the plus side, of course, for the Israelis. And I saw there's a puzzling comment to me from John Kirby at the podium yesterday, talking about a number of different issues, being asked various questions. And he was saying, well, with Israel's attempt to eliminate Hamas, he said you can never fully defeat a mindset or a worldview. And I guess that's true. Israel is not going to end jihadism or Islamism in Gaza by defeating Hamas, but that's not the military objective. They're not trying to uproot an entire ideology. They're trying to defeat a specific enemy in a specific place. I just found that to be a very weird kind of shifting of the paradigm from Kirby to say, oh, well, no matter what Israel does, they can't achieve this. Well, they're not trying to achieve that. They're trying to achieve something else that's pretty tangible, and I think quite achievable, especially if we had their backs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand what John Kirby is saying. It was the same argument of the forever war in Iraq, saying, well, you know, we'll never defeat all this, but we have to keep fighting, we have to keep fighting. Well, Donald Trump showed that, yeah, you could defeat ISIS. Look at how quickly we did it. Look at how quickly they eliminated the key people in ISIS, and how ISIS was a spent force by the time the Trump administration was finished. It's almost like John Kirby is saying, well, Israel, don't bother, because you'll never, ever really be able to be
That's
secure.
Exactly what that message was to me. Don't bother.
Yeah. Well, how can you possibly say that to an ally which has got its back up against the wall to say,
right,
don't bother to defend yourself against these evil people?
And then related to that, we had the story that broke 2 days ago, KT, I'm sure you saw it, that this administration was withholding ammunition, a delivery of ammunition to the Israelis, which was resulting in a lot of scrambling within Israel. Why is this happening? Are we going to get that ammo? The Biden administration saying that they're not going to comment on it. They're not confirming or denying those reports, which to me suggests that those reports are accurate. Congress just passed a supplemental to help Israel and to fund their war effort. If the administration is now withholding that money or some of the ammunition that money bought, I'm trying to figure out, is that even legal in terms of, you know, the constitutional order? Are they trying to do that to pressure the Israelis not to go into Rafah, saying, all right, actually, we're not going to give you what you need, and maybe you can, you know, do what we want you to do for political reasons? I just, again, find it astounding that in the middle of a war of survival against a genocidal terrorist group right on their doorstep, the United States of America is, at the very least, playing games like this with an ally like Israel.
Yeah, it's trying to slow walk it. Slow walking, you know, the resupply of military equipment. Now, I think that the way the administration leaked this, you know, it wasn't a statement coming out of the White House press secretary's office. It was reports saying that, well, the administration is thinking of slow walking or denying equipment to Israel. Look, the message was received in Israel saying, basically, the Biden administration saying, we don't want you to go into Rafah. We want you, I guess, the John Kirby version of events. Just give up. It's inevitable that you're going to be defeated. And so what's Israel supposed to do? I mean, Israel has no choice. Its survival is at stake. And the little signals the Biden administration is trying to throw one way or the other for its own political ambitions, again, not because of what's best for Israel, not because of what's best for the United States, but what's best for Joe Biden's electoral prospects. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't tell a country, don't defend yourself.
Right. And they're saying, well, you've done a lot of defending yourself and we've helped you so far, but it's good enough. You're never going to defeat all of them. You're not going to root them completely out. So let's avoid the Rafah thing. We've got a problem in Michigan. I mean, that's what is very obvious to me. Also, there is the Politico story about how so much of the Biden funding base for his reelection is bankrolling all of these protests and encampments in the United States. So I think they're conflicted on that front as well. And then there's this, KT. This is from Axios, and the reason why I think it's significant is Axios has a reporter that seems to be the conduit from the administration to the world in their leaks about Israel. They go to this guy all the time whenever they want to get their message out. So Axios is reporting, and this just took my breath away, because there's one thing to, let's say, hamstring the Israelis at this point and to string them along and try to slow walk things and prevent them from going into Rafah. And we heard that Biden told Netanyahu yesterday on the phone, don't go in. Whenever Biden says don't, that makes it almost inevitable that it's going to happen, because no one listens to him and no one respects his word, which is a separate problem. But hamstringing is still different than outright betrayal. And this Axios report smacks a lot more of betrayal to me. I'll just read. Officials claim that CIA Director Bill Burns and other Biden administration officials were involved in the negotiations. These are the ceasefire negotiations. And they knew about the new proposal, but didn't tell Israel. So this is the ceasefire that Hamas, quote unquote, agreed to yesterday. And it got a whole explosion of press all around the world. Hamas agrees to a ceasefire. And the Israelis said, well, hold on just a second. What is this? And they looked at the details. They said, no, this is, we never agreed to this. This is not what we had talked about. There was stuff involving the hostages that was completely unacceptable. The timeline was not acceptable to the Israelis. And so the Israelis were saying no. And then, of course, they began their operations in Rafah. The whole goal seemed to be a little bit of PR, good press for Hamas, seeming reasonable, even though they've rejected all the other ceasefires up to this point, all the other meaningful ones. And it was like a bait and switch, a trick, where they said yes to something that Israel hadn't agreed to. And now Axios is reporting that this was orchestrated, choreographed by the United States, with the Biden administration's knowledge, not giving Israel even a heads up that this was happening. Axios reporting, quote, the Israeli officials also said the last touches on this proposal were made on Monday morning in Doha, Qatar, with the Biden administration's knowledge. Two Israeli officials said the feeling is, quote, Israel got played by the U.S. and the mediators who drafted a new deal and weren't transparent about it. KT, my question is this. If Biden is extremely desperate for a ceasefire, for his political ambitions here domestically, does this sound to you like he told his team, go in there, don't tell Bibi, don't tell the Israeli unity government, come up with a new agreement that Hamas can say yes to, and then we'll spring it on the Israelis and make it seem awful if they don't accept it? That's my hypothesis on this. And if so, that would be, to me, a shocking betrayal. What do you think here?
I completely agree with you. And again, I do think it's the Biden administration looking for some kind of victory in all this. And they want to be able to say to the world, well, you know, we had a deal. Israel just wouldn't go along with it. We, the United States, finally at the 11th hour brokered a deal that Hamas accepted, and then Israel wouldn't. So they're setting the whole thing up so that if they can blame Israel. You know, they're always looking for somebody else to blame, never themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think, frankly, you know, when we have presidential elections, we're electing leaders. We're not electing people who are trying to get reelected again. And I wish the Biden administration would take its leadership responsibilities seriously.
Can you reflect just for a moment on a previous point that I raised, which is the don't foreign policy from Joe Biden? Because he and his group around him, that upper echelon, the brain trust, they go out there to the cameras and they say don't to our enemies and also to our allies when it suits them, don't. Whether it's on camera or they leak that they're telling people not to do something. And then whether it's an adversary or nominally a friend, it seems like the opposite happens anyway. That is, you would think that there would be some capacity for embarrassment here where they say, we better stop telling people not to do things because then they do them anyway, and then we do diddly squat in response. It just looks utterly weak and impotent.
Well, there's two problems with it. The first problem is they're living in a fantasy world that the United States no longer dictates world events. Maybe we did after World War II, but just because the President of the United States says, we want you guys to do this, this, and this, it doesn't necessarily mean countries are going to do it anymore. The second thing is that once you start drawing red lines and making threats like don't, and then you don't carry it out, if you don't stand up, then it's not only do you look silly, et cetera, but you are far more weak than if you just had not said anything. So to set a red line, to make a threat and not carry it out, how many other leaders are looking at President Biden and saying, well, look what he did, all the red lines he's drawn. I'm China. I'm thinking, huh, he
exactly.
says stuff about me. I think this is my moment. I'll press it. But Putin does the same thing. Iran does the same thing. So it's far worse when they make these threats and then don't carry them out. It really puts the United States in a far weaker position.
Well, they say what? Weakness is provocative? Mm. This is encapsulated, embodied in one man, Joe Biden. Weakness is provocative and it's dangerous, not just for Israel, but for all the other reasons that you just mentioned, just bouncing around the globe, which just kind of makes you shudder. And it does throw into stark relief some of the stakes, I would say, coming up in November when Americans will be making choices about the next commander-in-chief. KT McFarland has worked for four of them through the years, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Trump. She's our guest here on The Guy Benson Show. KT, as always, we really do appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
And we'll be right back.
Same issues, but with a fresh perspective. The Guy Benson Show.
The happy hour continues here on The Guy Benson Show. Last night, I was on Gutfeld, which was fun. What a crew. It was Greg, of course, hosting. And then Jimmy Fallon, Kat Timpf, Tyrus. So very fun panel. And at the very end of the show, they had an installment called Poo Detective. And in that episode of Poo Detective, the discussion surrounded a viral video of our president, Joe Biden, walking on the South Lawn and then pausing and looking, let's say, chagrined. And the conversation online has been that perhaps he had an accident in that moment. I don't actually believe that's what happened, but you can at least see why people might believe that. And so this was a topic for us. And at one point, Jimmy Fallon stood up and reenacted it and was describing things. And I was just sitting there having a surreal moment where we are talking about certain bodily functions and the president of the United States on national television. I wasn't really sure how I felt about that. So here's how it went down in Cut 27.
His pants. And do you want to know how? It's not because of the stop. It's because not only did he poop his pants, just to be clear, mm-hmm. okay, this is someone who does it regularly. We know this. Why? Because he stopped and then he leaned in. Why? Because that makes the cleanup easier if you get it all the way out. This is an experienced pant. And that's unfortunate. But that's what the Democrats did. They could have had Newsom.
Somebody understands this.
Yes. I just have an inquiry, a very quick inquiry. Can I be edited out of this segment? And the answer apparently is no, because that made it to air. I am not going to endorse or reject the theory of what happened in that video involving Joe Biden. I am just going to stay scrupulously out of the speculation. And I just hope for the best for him, for his dry cleaner, for anyone who might have been involved. The Guy Benson Show continues with the happy hour right after this break.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
The great Douglas Murray is a Fox News contributor, National Review Institute fellow, and author of the book The War on the West, at Douglas K. Murray on social media, and he was our guest earlier in the program today. Here's part of that conversation with Douglas Murray. I presume some of them have no idea what it means, and it sounds exciting and somewhat, you know, foreign and mysterious and dangerous, so they're kind of excited by that, and it's almost romanticized to them. It's exotic. Ooh, okay, Intifada, this is what they're telling us to chant. We'll just repeat it back. That's some of them. Others, I'm sure, absolutely know what it means, and they're for it. They just assume they would be spared. They wouldn't be the ones killed. It would be Jews, right, especially the Zionist Jews. They'd be the ones killed, and maybe some other Zionists like you and me, but they would be spared from an intifada. Maybe they'd be the ones partaking in the intifada. It's hard to kind of absolve them of that, isn't it?
Well, all of these people fall into two categories, the sinister and the silly. The sinister are the ones who actually do love this. They love the fact that clearly that American students were killed at the university in Jerusalem in 2001 at the cafeteria suicide bombing. Presumably they love that. So these are people who love the murder and mutilation of American students their own age. So those are the really sinister ones, that we're very unlucky to have such sick and deranged people on our campuses or on our streets. But as for the silly, how incredibly ridiculous, stupid, and mentally impaired do you have to be to shout something you don't know what it even means? I mean, you know, I reckon I'm quite a bright guy. You're a bright guy. If we were at an American campus and somebody just started chanting some word we didn't know, would we join in? No. Would we ask what a word meant before we chanted it?
I'd be Googling. Be Googling on my phone.
So.
Yeah.
I reckon I'd have a quick look beforehand at exactly what it was. So how incredibly dumb do these silly students have to be? What ghouls they are, what ill-educated ghouls they are, that they stand on campus and shout words they don't understand. They have no right to be on a campus if they're that stupid. I mean, nobody with any cognitive ability goes around shouting slogans they don't understand. So I find the silly to be just as problematic, to use one of their favorite words, as the sinister.
The clips we played for you were from Boston or Greater Boston, MIT. Then yesterday in New York, you had some other charming scenes. Some of these people tried to disrupt the Met Gala. And in the process, well, here in Cut 5 were a number of young women in the full Muslim headscarves chanting at the police, Cut 5. Oink, oink, piggy, piggy, talking to the police, we will make your lives, and then a word that we can't use. Doesn't quite rhyme, but, you know, they can only do so well. That is one scene, a handful of them. There was another scene nearby, a war memorial, a memorial to our war dead, where they desecrated it with spray paint, with Palestinian garb and flags, and they also burned an American flag in front of it. Douglas, I know some people say, look, even if we support Israel, Guy, you're talking about this a lot, it goes so much deeper than Israel. It goes so much deeper than the well-being of Jews. Those are both extremely important to me. But it's about people who hate our civilization, hate our law enforcement, hate what should be sacred to this country, our veterans, our war dead, our flag. I think that's something that instinctively gets a rise out of so many Americans, including some of the people leading the backlash on some of these campuses.
Yes. I mean, what everybody needs to realize is that Israel is now, as it has been for many years since the global left decided to adopt it as their bogeyman, Israel is just simply the first country in the sights of these maniacs. But it's always here in America that their sights really are. You know, they attack Israel for being colonialist. Israel's never had a colony. It's founded in 1948, and they don't know what they're even talking about. But they say colonialist about Israel because they want to say colonialist about America. They claim that Israel is some kind of white supremacist society, and I'd invite them to go to Israel any day, and they'll see that that's not accurate. Not just not white supremacist, but not white. An incredibly diverse population. But they want to say white supremacist about Israel in order to say it about America next. And they want to ban the Star of David. They want to burn the Star of David in order to burn the flag of the United States of America next.
My full interview with Douglas Murray available online, GuyBensonShow.com, also part of the free podcast, the entire show, from word one till the close, every day, on demand, absolutely free, at GuyBensonShow.com or FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you download your podcasts. When we come back, the home stretch, earlier this hour I talked about something I wanted to be edited out of on Gutfeld last night, sort of joking about that. Well, Cookie has a similar request. We'll see if we can grant it when we come back.
America is listening to The Guy Benson Show.
Home stretch on The Guy Benson Show on this Tuesday. We're in D.C. We'll be somewhere much farther away, God willing, tomorrow for the show, so please tune in for that. GuyBensonShow.com every day. That's our online home. Lots of content there, including the free podcasts, the whole show. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, wherever you get your podcasts, as we like to remind you repeatedly. So, producer Christine's new hero, her idol, Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota, she has been on this book tour promoting her latest work. And yeah, she's getting a lot of attention. They say all publicity is good publicity. I'm not sure that's always true, because this book tour kind of feels more like a self-immolation than it does anything approaching positive public relations. We'll see how the book does. But in terms of interviews regarding the book, it is not going well for the governor. She was on Face the Nation this week, and she's doing tons of interviews. None of them are successful, because these journalists, sometimes you can blame the press for cherry-picking or being biased. In these cases, you have all sorts of different journalists just reading her own quotes from her own book written under her name. And she seems like faux offended that people are doing this, and that they're noticing things that have really made a lot of people very angry, particularly about shooting the puppy. She also killed a goat that she boasts about in the book. There is also a whole story about meeting Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea. That appears to be untrue, so she's saying that's going to be edited. She was on with Jesse Waters last night on Fox. So not necessarily automatically hostile terrain for a conservative governor. But Jesse had some questions. Noem had some answers, I guess. Cut 25.
What happens if you are debating Kamala Harris and she says, well, wait a second, you shot your dog and you wrote a book about it, bragging about it. How can you be vice president?
You know, that story was a choice as a mom. The safety of my children versus a dangerous dog that was killing livestock and attacking people. So this book that I've written is full of stories of my past, hard decisions, and I told the truth. And I think that's very different than a lot of politicians that we have today.
Do you regret telling that story? Do you feel like, oh, maybe I should have said it? Do you understand why people don't like that story?
No, everybody's known that story for years. That's what most people don't realize, is that in South Dakota, they've used that story to attack me and my political campaigns for years. I wanted people to know the truth. This dog was vicious. It was dangerous. It was killing livestock for the joy of it and attacking people. And I had a choice between keeping my family safe. I had little kids at the time. A very public business of inviting people out to come out and enjoy our hunting lodge and our business. And I don't pass my responsibilities off to anybody else. So that story is in the book because I want people to know that I'm honest, and that I, when I have difficult jobs, that I take responsibility myself.
All right, so you're standing by the dog story.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's the facts.
Okay, well, there are reports out there, and I've heard that she has told different versions of this story in the past. This is the latest iteration of it. There's a report also that she had tried to insert something like this story in a previous book, and the previous publisher and editor said, yeah, let's not. That's a little weird. That's very alienating. So it got pushed off into this book, which is now coming out right in the middle of the Veep stakes. I mean, I think she's cooked, because she's flailing. And some of the details that she's now insisting, oh, it's to protect the children, that's apparently not the story that's always been told, and in certain respects, not even what was written in the book. She's kind of expanding on the excuse or the justification now on the book tour, because she's getting a lot of heat for shooting the puppy. Then what about this Kim Jong-un? Because, by the way, she also killed a goat. Is the goat attacking people and killing livestock and going to murder her kids, so you got to kill the goat? I mean, you got a body count here now that is rising for Kristi Noem. And then, as I was about to say, Kim Jong-un, this anecdote in her book that she wrote, even if she had help, ghostwriters or whatever, this is her book with her name on it. She is now saying kind of playing coy about whether the meeting that she said happened, the conversation that she claims happened, ever actually happened. But she's now taking it out of the book for future versions of it, or when it goes to press down the line. Cut 26.
They're also attacking you. I guess you said you met Kim Jong-un. Mm-hmm. Did you meet him?
I've been to the DMZ. I've been to North Korea. You know, people, I don't talk about my conversations with world leaders. And so when I looked at the book and I saw that excerpt, I decided to make the change to the content of the book, and that's been done.
So you didn't have a conversation with Kim when you were at the DMZ?
I don't have conversations about my conversations with world leaders. I've been working on policy for 30 years, Jesse, and that's what most people don't remember about me is I'm old. I'm a mom, I'm a grandma, I've got three little grandbabies.
You're not that old. So maybe you did have a conversation with Kim, but you don't want to talk
about it. I will not talk about my personal conversations with any world leaders. It just won't, and I'm not going to do it.
That just doesn't make any sense. She put it in the book. She made it up and put it in the book, and then when people noticed that it's not true, she's now playing this game like, oh, she's just being very discreet. She's not going to have an indiscretion like talking about a world leader conversation that she had, even though that's exactly what she did by putting it in the book in the first place. Incidentally, she was on another network because she said, oh, well, when I saw the book, then I decided we should take it out. No. That's not how this works. Even with a ghostwriter, it's not like you suddenly get to read what was published under your name after the book is out. If she had a problem with disclosing this discussion that she had with Kim Jong-un, which apparently never happened, but if she's like, well, hang on, I told you that in confidence, ghostwriter, and we can't put that in the book, take it out, that would have been done much earlier on in the process, not after the book was published. And as I was getting to, in another interview on a different network, it was noted she voiced the audiobook for this book. She read it all. I have also read for an audiobook of End of Discussion with Mary Catherine Hamm. It's actually quite a tedious process. Nothing is a surprise to you. It's all your words coming out under your name, and in this case, coming out of her mouth. Couldn't she have at that time said, well, hang on now. I'm now telling a story about Kim Jong-un that isn't true, although she's trying to pretend like it is true. It's like, oh, well, it's secret, so I'm not going to tell you any secrets. You put it in the book in the first place. It didn't happen. And now the fallback is, oh, I can't betray the secret. Maybe you could have had that light bulb go off when you were reading it out loud into a microphone for posterity and permanent recording for the audiobook that you're going to ask people to buy? It just doesn't make any sense at all. Then this morning, she was on with Stuart Varney. I was on Varney and Company yesterday in New York. This went a little different in terms of the tone and the tenor. Cut 24.
I still think that you are in line to be Trump's vice president.
No, it's up to Donald Trump. He's the only person who will decide this.
Yeah,
he's the
him,
only person who will decide. And I spoke. Yes, I do speak to him.
May I ask what
yes.
he said to you about
yes.
being
no,
vice president?
No, I never tell anybody my personal conversations.
Did
with
the dog story
president
come up
Trump.
In a conversation?
I
with
talk
Trump?
To President Trump all the time
about the dog,
about a lot of things. And right now, I tell you what, he is being persecuted in a political hunt. Witch hunt in this court case. So I'm proud of him about how tough he is and how well he is doing.
Did you bring up
yes,
the dog?
Yes, enough,
with Trump,
Stuart.
With Trump. Did you
this
bring
interview
up the
dog is
with
ridiculous,
Trump?
What you are doing right now.
I don't
so
think
you
so.
Need to stop. It is.
Okay.
It is.
We'll
Let's
stop.
Talk about some real topics that Americans care about.
I'm afraid we're out of time.
Oh, well, of course we are.
We do thank you for being with us.
Right.
I know I pressed hard, but that's what people are talking about
no.
to this day.
Yeah.
Yeah. This interview is ridiculous. You need to stop. You put it in your own book, lady. And a good reason why you might not be anywhere close to the top of the list anymore is because Americans don't like the idea of someone summarily executing their 14-month-old puppy. Though she was getting pretty ornery there, tired of being pressed on the things that she put out into public. Her choices, her decisions. And now she's a victim because people noticed and are asking about it. I mean, what a debacle of a book tour. She is scheduled to be on Gutfeld tonight. I was just on Gutfeld yesterday. It's like she's following me through the building. I would just say stay tuned. We'll see how that goes, if it goes. In any case, I began the whole segment talking about how this woman is producer Christine's new favorite. I mean, she loves Kristi Noem. I'm not sure if she's donated now to Kristi Noem or volunteering for her campaign. She went to bat for Kristi and the dog killing and all of it last week here on the show. Was informed by multiple people close to the program that it was perhaps her worst take ever, which is really saying something, over years of home stretches. Christine, you said something rather curious earlier. It seemed like you were trying to maybe go back and figure out a way of permanently deleting an episode of the podcast.
I mean, I went to bat last week for her?
Yes.
No. I mean, Justin, you can speak up. We tried. I didn't find any audio that said I actually went to bat and a huge fan of hers. Never.
It was the whole home stretch. What was it, last? Was it last Wednesday or Thursday, Justin?
Yeah, I've been given order from someone in the higher up to not speak about this.
I don't recall.
Does she have a governor in the studio pointing a gun at you by any chance?
I'm not saying. I fear for my safety here in this chair.
Okay. Listen, I just told Justin, let's forget about finding any audio from last week, okay? Capiche?
Yeah. I would ask him to blink if he's in trouble, but it's radio, so that wouldn't really help. So for Justin's physical well-being, we should probably just move on. But Christine, is it safe to say perhaps that you've taken your hardcore support for Kristi Noem out back to the gravel pit and, you know, taking care of it?
Yeah, it's done.
All right. Tomorrow, we're going to be in a very different part of the country. I'm really looking forward to this, getting on a plane here in just a few minutes. Please tune in, same time, same place for the Guy Benson Show. We will talk to you then.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.